You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. We've got a great guest in store for you guys today. But like we always do, we kick things off with a Patreon question of the day. Today's Patreon question of the day is, what was the worst job you have ever had? Worst job you have ever had?
Okay, worst job. I've been working since I was a little kid, like very, very young age. And I mean, I've done very pretty worst jobs, but I think the worst, I mean, there's no worst. Every one of them was a kind of life challenge and a step, but I never looked at it, to be honest, as a worst and favorite. But you know, that regular selling stuff like a vendor, yeah. That was one of my kind of, if you can call it worst, because that had a lot of more challenges compared to the other ones.
That would be hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you have the garment, you have the cops chasing you around, and you're just a little kid and running around. Like, and I had my stuff, selling stuff. I didn't have a cart. So I had this piece of, cloth on the ground, and then I would put my stuff. I was selling toys and stuff, but still, garment has their own policies and everything. And so when you would see cops, we would start chasing. I mean, we start running and they would chase us. Sometimes you get caught, they will seize, confiscate everything you have. And I mean, that was all the investment you have for back then. For us, it worth like thousands of dollars, because that's what everything like we had. But you know, I still don't call it worse, but it was not a good experience.
Not your favorite, yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, babe?
I don't know. I don't have a worst either. That's kind of a relative term. The hardest thing I ever did was roof a house with my brother one time. It was an ass whipper. That's the one I remember the worst. That's even after being in the SEAL teams and everything.
Yeah, it's a hot day outside. I think that mine would probably be... I haven't had too many really bad jobs, so I should probably skip this one. I would say probably babysitting for people that, like, they said they'd be home by a certain time, then they don't show up, and you think you're going home at 7 o'clock, and you don't end up getting home till 10 or so.
Yeah.
As a teenager, you want...
You're ready to be done.
Yeah, you're just ready to be done, so I think that was probably the hardest.
All right, Yusuf, how old are you, man?
I'm 33 and never celebrated any birthdays. That's a little hard to remember.
Yeah. Well, we start celebrating them now, man, after all the hard work that you did. So when we talked about this, man, we're going to back it up a little bit. I know you don't want to talk too much about where you're from and the background on your family, man, but being from Afghanistan and fighting in the wars and doing what you did and and how hard you worked for it, and the list of accolades that you have on this sheet of paper in front of you, man, it couldn't have been an easy feat. What we like to do is tell everybody a little bit about yourself and how you got to sit in front of me right now and for us to talk about this. But if you can, man, let's back it up a little bit. Are you born in Afghanistan?
Yep, I was born in northern Afghanistan in a small village, and we were close to Bagram, the airfield. So,
what was that like? Talk about that growing up in Afghanistan. Most people see the mountains and the desert parts of it, and they don't see the beautiful parts or the ongoings on the inside, because it's all been about war. And the first time anybody paid attention to Afghanistan is when they started fighting.
Yeah, you know, we've been there. It's a beautiful country. It's like all nature, not a lot of cities, rural areas. You would go to, villages that people still don't have access to the, TVs and stuff. They don't even know what's going on around the world. But so, we had a big family. As usual, most Afghans have big families, and we were one of them. And then on the other side, poverty was one of the problems. And then we were like, six, seven brothers, and, we were a big family.
Is that technically what big is? 7 to 10 kids?
Yeah, so we were total like 9. And then, unfortunately, I lost 2 of my oldest sisters when they were very little to starvation. And then, so back then, 7 of us were left, and then 2 more added at the end of my father's journey in his life. I mean, he's still alive, but so we were total of like 11 brothers and sisters, beside the 2 that, unfortunately, they had to leave the world pretty early because of, situations and challenges. And we couldn't, we didn't have enough food. And my father was, he was in the military, military.
His Afghani military?
Yeah. He was a former officer he was back when we had the Russians.
Yeah, he fought the Russians, right?
Yeah. He was, at the beginning, he was, because he was graduated from the school back then, it wasn't a requirement to be, university or college graduate. So he was a high school graduate, and then he became an officer. And then, he didn't retire, but, government collapsed, and he, kind of retired as a colonel. And but back then he was a cap. I think he was lieutenant or captain, and the wages or the salary wasn't good enough for a big family. And the country, the economy was pretty bad. And living in an era of communism and you have that Russian thing, and then you don't have. But like everything was like, like back 80s and 90s, especially for Afghanistan, a third world country. And then everybody was working, like me, as I was very, very young. But as I told you, I don't exactly remember the dates, but I was very young that I was, that was the least thing I could do to help the family. I was taking the sheep, and we had just, just few sheep. And I was taking them early morning, like 4 or 5 in the morning in the dark, with a stick in my hand, going to the mountains, just to, feed them. Because the village we were living in was more like, rocks and mountains. So you had to find a very good spot for the sheep and goats to, you can feed them. And then, from there, it went up, we started slowly get a little better. We were all living in one room. Didn't have any windows because of, it was a mud house built of mud, which is pretty common in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And because mud is, clay is easy, dirt is there, water is there. It's easy to build. Don't need much construction tools and equipment. And then later, just a few hours, 5, 6, when we moved to nearby, one of the closest cities that was close to our village. We walked, I don't remember the exact, but it was like almost 24 hours just walking down the road because there was no cars to get to the, that little city that was close to us. And then from there, we were in that city for a few years, and then we moved to Kabul City. And from, so all these areas are like we were all living in poverty, like everybody. We were making minimum. Most of the times we weren't even making anything. And then my mom, she was working in a house for this family as a servant. So at the end of the day, they weren't giving us, they weren't giving my mom or family salaries. It was just, they would give you food and stuff at the end. And it was like, you know, we were happy. At the end of the day, we were just, you know, like, oh God, we were happy that we exist. And it's a challenge. We try to push through it, get better. And then, you know, by the time then these, I call them shitheads, but sorry, Taliban, they showed up. And then, you know, country went, economy went worse. Everything was bad.
So talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind. So what, to break down the dynamic in the Afghan villages, is it each village mainly like a family, like the same family? Or is each house have a different family? Are you related to like your cousins and everything? And when the Taliban showed up, talk about that a little bit. Is it just like a gang walking down the street and they show up in your neighborhood? Or is it more structured?
Yeah, sure. But there's more like very detailed kind of information that people, especially on this side of the world, they don't know about it. Which was, so first coming back to the villages, it's pretty common, like, you know, Afghan villages all over the country, they are, you know, traditional. They have to help each other at the good times, bad times. And so basically everybody know each other. Like weddings, when weddings were happening in the village, everybody was invited. Yeah. Whether you like it or you don't like them, they were invited. Because if their wedding happened, then you're also invited. So it's like, we all know each other. We are, you know, we are in it at the same time. And if it's bad, if it's good, like funerals, if somebody dies in the village, if he's young, if he's old, male, female, a lot of, like, everybody show up in the whole village. Like everybody, you would see at least like 1,000 people, 800 people. That was like regular. Same thing for wedding. While they're coming to help you when you're in a pretty bad situation, like, you know, losing some a loved one, then on weddings they will of course show up, help. It wasn't just all the time to get feed. They weren't there for the food, but they were there to help you, and because, you know, it's hard to serve all these people, so you cook for them, and then everybody eats, and then they help you and clean the house, and after that they walk with you, because we were living in a village, so we were still using horse. Was pretty expensive. Horse was like you having a Bugatti back then, so mainly donkeys. We didn't have camels because Afghanistan is not really like they have parts that they used camels, but not northern Afghanistan, so we had donkeys.
Yeah, what's the difference on that, because I've only seen a few.
You know, Afghanistan has the south side and east side, north side and west side. North is, you know, it have people in the north, they have almost like a very different culture. And then people in the south, they have a very different culture. And the weather are very different. Like north is cold. It snows a lot in the winter. And, you know, the weather gets pretty cold and it's more mountainous. And there are, like, of course, deserts, but it's like more green. And then you have the south side, which is more desert, like Kandahar, Helmand, Zabul, like Ghazni. These are the provinces that you go from Kabul. Mainly, you know, everybody knows, of course, Helmand and Kandahar. And then you have Uruzgan. These are all like areas that, you know, it's more deserted. Like there is less green, more desert. And just few mountains. So some people were using camels because of, you know, that distance that you can get water.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, camels go for a very long ride with just, you know, minimum water. And then that was the difference. And then you have Eastern Afghanistan, which was, of course, you've been to like Jaybad, yeah, or Jalalabad or Nangarhar, Konar, Nuristan. These areas are like all green, mountainous, and then the weather is also a little bit different. So the weather is more of like you have Pacific here, like California and Texas. So Eastern Afghanistan weather is like that. In the summer, it's pretty hot, but still green and beautiful. And in the winter, it doesn't snow there. just, you know, a small part of it. And then, you know, it was mainly, you know, mainly it rains, but it's always green. That's why they call Jalalabad or Nangarhar, one of the eastern provinces, the always green province. Like, it's always green if you go there in summer, if you go there in winter. And then you have the west side of the country, which is Khost, Paktia, Paktika. These are also bordered with Pakistan, and there are like steep mountains, and you don't see much green. It's a mix of like a little green and a little desert. Yeah. So that was the difference between the four side of the country.
Yeah. Every time I try to explain it, and even before we went over, it would have helped out a lot if they made it relative to the United States. Because when I go into this city, what city is it like? Is Kandahar like New York? Is it like Houston or something? And then when they started breaking it down like that from the north, south, east, and west, like if you're in the mountains in a certain part of the country, you're dealing with mountain people. Mountain people act a certain way. It's always cold. They always got to climb the mountains. They're in a good or bad mood. Same way with city folks. And it took a while. I remember rolling around in there for a while before I started seeing that. It took one of my chiefs to even point it out to me. But it definitely helps when you're rolling around in the area, if you know it. The best thing we had is when we hooked up with y'all, when y'all started stepping up.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, to come to your point, that was one of when I was, you know, doing the stuff with the U.S. forces. Well, that was one of my, you know, key points. I always emphasized that, you know, I'm sure, I don't know what was the experience like back in the early years of the Operation Enduring Freedom. They were using Afghans that they were born in the U.S.
Yeah.
Or migrated like long ago to U.S.
Yeah.
And, you know, that wasn't good. I was always said use locals and listen to the locals. Of course, you know, don't trust everybody, but the one that you trust, listen to them, because they've been in the country, they know everything. But the ones that are in the U.S., they have not been in the country for a long time. Most of them were not even born in Afghanistan, so they don't know the culture. But, you know, that was one of the part that made stuff a little confusing for the troops when they were coming in. So,
I mean, real confusing. It's like giving you intel that doesn't have any idea. Well, just because they identify as that doesn't mean they can help you with it.
Exactly. Yeah, we had, you know, we call them the Cat 2, Cat 3 Terps, and the interpreter, the Terps is the short form. It's not that's a made up word for in the military. They call the translators Terps, and so we had the Cat 2 and Cat 3 Terps that they were getting like, you know, way you know, more salary than, of course, the locals. Like, some of them were at the beginning were getting like 15, and then if you have top secret clearance, you would get almost like 18-20k a month. And it was all because they had that name tag on them that they were after.
I remember.
But they didn't have, as you said, they didn't have any information on what was going on in the country and what's currently going on. And they, most of times, of course, not all of them, but some of them were even scared of to go outside the wire because, you know, that tells you like they are not familiar with the area. That's why, you know, especially special operations, they were always, keying and listening to their local Terps they had, because they knew the value for the locals.
Bro, I had your ass glued to my hip anytime we went out the door. That was the way it was, man. I still talk about our Terps from a couple of my deployments. They were so good. You can't get anything done without them. You just can't get anything done. I mean, it's like having your own personal intel officer. It's the best.
Oh, yeah.
So exactly. When did you get wrapped? Obviously, how old are you? We talked about that a little bit. So when the Russians came in, y'all had that break because that was 20 years of war. The whole country was fighting. I mean, everybody was in on that one.
Yeah. So, but I'm coming back to your question about the, you know, Taliban, when you asked that, did they can walk in as a gang in the country? So the situation with the Taliban, everybody knows about the war in Afghanistan back when the Russians were in the country. And, back then, the Northern Alliance people who were fighting, you know, the Northern Resistance Force fighting the Russians, they, you know, we call them Mujahideen, which means holy warrior in Islamic terms or in our language. And then, you know, of course, they were, of course, you know, everybody knows this. They were getting support by the U.S. to fight the Russians and all that thing. And the Russians left the country. You know, of course, they got their ass kicked and they left the country. And then, so after Russians, when they left the country, it was, I think, 89 or something, dates close to that. And because we use the Afghan dates, it's a little sometimes hard to convert them back to the, you know, English dates. And then we did not have a person or a good leader. So, you know, as I told you, Afghanistan has south, east, west, north, right? Every part of this country, I mean, they have their own leaders because they have different culture. They have, different language that they speak. And so they have their own leaders. When they were fighting the Russians, every part had their own leader. Southern Afghanistan had Mullah Omar, the, you know, of course, the what they call it, the creator of the Taliban network. And then, you know, you have Ahmad Shah Massoud in the north side. And then you have Gulbuddin Hekmatyar on the east side. And on the west side, there were like, you know, a bunch of names. They weren't really famous. So, the civil war started between the Afghans. I won the power. I won the power. And like, South won the power, North, the guy from the North wants the power. That created a chaos, and, you know, people started robbing people, and people were getting killed when they were traveling. You know, women were getting killed, and unfortunately, you know, getting harassed, tortured, raped. Kids, the same thing, were getting killed. People were, you know, so the situation went very bad in the kind of civil wars thing. In Kabul City, so these four, jihadi commanders, they're fighting each other. They didn't care, you know. We didn't have a school, but when we were going to the city, because we had to walk, or sometimes you get lucky, you find a bicycle, and then they would shoot at you. They didn't care. These were Afghans shooting at the other Afghans. There were no Russians on that time, and then they would shoot at you just for fun. Because, you know, that mentality that rogue, being like kind of pirate kind of mentality that you have to be out there fighting all the time and killing and killing. So this was the thing. Uneducated people, everybody, like, sometimes they were just testing their weapons on a random pedestrian that they were walking down the street. So the civil war was pretty bad. It was among the Afghans. And then on 95, I think was it, then people in southern Afghanistan started complaining, the locals, that we need somebody to help us. So this village, which is in Khakrez district, this is where I was with the SEAL Team 4 and Team 10. And then Mullah Omar, he was the Taliban leader, the former Taliban leader. He was a priest, which we, you know, in the Islamic way, we call it mullah, but in, you know, we, in Christianity, you guys call it priest or the guy who runs the church, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
So he was running this mosque as a mullah or as a, you know, the Muslim priest. And then people started asking him, because he used to fight with the Russians back in the time, and they're asking him like, oh, please help us. And then so Mullah Omar stood up with a bunch of guys from this little village. And they started taking over Kandahar city in one day. Like, the Kandahar fallen very quick, like very quick. Then they took over, Kandahar, Zabul, Helmand, Oruzgan are very close to each other, and they all speak Pashto. And the Mullah Omar was Pashtun. And so that southern Afghanistan fallen pretty quick. And then from there, when they gained that power, they started marching toward, Kabul and then toward northern Afghanistan. And that's how, because people were tired, they wanted peace, they wanted to live in peace. And they were assuming maybe, you know, Taliban are good because they are from the people. They're, you know, people resisting these cruel warlords. So they walk and they came into Kabul. And then we have the neighboring snake on our right side, which is Pakistan. Pakistan intelligence service, they wanted to influence Afghanistan pretty bad, because back when we had a lot of power, when the Russians were there, the government was good, the army was strong, we had jets, we had, you know, fighting jets, we had been a lot of the army was pretty strong. And then Pakistan was always terrified of Afghanistan, and they never wanted to see Afghanistan developed and strong, because they looked at the Afghanistan as a threat. And on the other side, you have Iran. Iran is the same thing. You know, the neighboring countries, they never want to see somebody, like, especially like a country like Afghanistan develop, because these people been in war and, they, you know, they just scare people off. So story short, then, you know, the ISI influenced the Taliban when they came into Kabul. Back in, I think it was close between 1995-96, the former Afghan president, his name was Dr. Najib. He was in a UN compound, like a safe house, and he was protected by the UN. So he said, you know, I'm happy to hand over the government to you guys officially on a piece of paper, but, you know, don't kill me and don't kill my family. So what the Taliban did back in that time, they took him off the UN compound. And then, unfortunately, he was a very good president for because he wanted good for the country. They killed his brother first, and then they executed both of them in the Kabul city in a crowded area of the Kabul city, like the downtown. And then after they executed both of, you know, the president and his brother, then they hang him in the city as an example. These were the part that we had the ISI already influenced among the Taliban. So you had ISIs that they didn't want. The regular Taliban, they were fine with the president, but ISI, they didn't want him, so they influenced them. They had a lot of people in the Taliban leadership. And of course, you know, that 5 years, a very bad time, you know, feeling like you're in a prison, because bunch of illiterate people trying to educate you on your religion that they don't even know a very small part of that religion. And then, you know, people, they want to keep you back in that 200 years ago situation. They don't want you to go to school. They don't want you study. And then schools were all locked down. So they use the schools for, you know, religious studies. And of course, you know, religions are, if you're not expert at it, people can manipulate you pretty easy. Like, you know, back in the Crusade Wars, that Christian situation we had, and then we had the Muslims with this situation, because you don't know, and it's all faith and belief. And they came in, these people with the long beards, oh, you know, there's a holy war, you have to be prepared for it. And then, you know, they train you, they give you that brainwashed situation, which was, okay, if you fight, no matter what, you will go to heaven. And of course, that 72 or 42 virgins are waiting for you. And that young guy with boiled blood in his body, and, you know, he doesn't have anything to lose. And he's like, okay, if I die, you know, I'm going to go to heaven. And, you know, of course, it's a win-win situation for me. So that's how they manipulated people to stay with the Taliban. But I know it was a pretty bad time. Women and children were oppressed. And people, if you're a woman walking in the street, and if you don't have socks and somebody can see your feet, they would use a whip and started beating you. I mean, whipping you. And then if you try to fight them, they will. I'm sure you guys all have seen that video that they execute that woman in the street. She's wearing that blue burqa. She was executed for. I wasn't there, but we were close when she was executed. She was executed for not wearing socks. And I'm very educated in my religion, and there's nowhere in Islam that says anything about if you're bare feet or somebody can see your feet, you have to be whipped. But, you know, people are uneducated, nobody's fighting them, and people are starving, starvation, poverty, and people are dying. And so it was a pretty dark era. Like, it was pretty bad. And so that was the Taliban. I mean, of course, there's like much more detailed into that Taliban, whole Taliban thing.
Oh, sure.
With the stuff they did. But generally, if you want to like kind of brief it out, it's like you have Kim Jong-un, and then you have Putin, and then you have this bunch of people with no brain running a country. So assume what the outcome would be.
Yeah. How old were you when you started mixing up into the military?
So the back then, they were looking for people to, that they could speak English, because it was people weren't going to war zone. Everybody wanted to work like in the Kabul city. And I was 16. I was 16 years old, and the requirement age was 18 years old to become a TERP or work for the U.S. Military. And then I really wanted to become a TERP. The only reason was that it might be funny. It's funny for me when I sometimes look at it, because I wanted to have a good gym and some good food. And of course, the salary was a part of it, but mainly so I can have some good food for after like all these years. And for me, I created this fake Afghan ID, which Afghan IDs were back then were a piece of paper with a picture on it, and then these bunch of stamps and some of information. So I did change that to 18. My 16 years old ID, I changed it to 18, and then I went to these camps like Camp Phoenix in Kabul City.
Yeah.
They were hiring TERPs. And unfortunately, some of the TERPs that they were, like the locals or the TERPs that they were hiring, new TERPs, had this little attitude. I still remember, and even though the military had big demand for these TERPs, because there were a lot of operations going on, and they needed people that speak English. But these TERPs with the attitude in Camp Phoenix, and they failed me for, I did not know one word. He asked me for one English word. I didn't know that word. It was about election or something. I got so pissed, and I was like, man, if you just fail me for one word, I'm sure you can go ask some of these English speakers, even some Americans, Canadians, and British. Some people might fail in not knowing one word, but that doesn't mean I don't know English. So anyway, I failed, and then I was pissed. Of course, you failed, and that was my dream job because of the gym, food, and I wanted to experience this new life, and because we were in war, and I wanted to experience this new thing. So I went to Kandahar. And then the story is like, it's pretty not really scary for me, but maybe scary for a lot of people. I had to go through a lot of Taliban checkpoints and drive almost 8 hours in these Taliban checkpoints and areas to get to Kandahar. And I only have money in my pocket that if I pass, great. If I don't pass, I have to walk back from Kandahar because I don't have more money to, buy a ticket or a bus ticket or get a taxi to come back to Kabul. So I didn't even think about that. I was like, oh, let's borrow some money. I was like, okay, I'm going to pass. I just had this feeling like, God will be on my side. I'm going to go. And then I was 17 when I joined the coalition forces as a TERP, and I started working as a TERP.
So you get to Kandahar and you pass?
Oh, yeah. So the funny thing was that this interview was very easy. It was like very easy interview. And because they knew these TERPs, these Afghans or these locals that they're coming into these kind of compounds to do the interview, they don't know. They knew English, but they are not very good at it. So they would give them chances to get better when they get to the bases. So at least, it would help give them at least a small hand to the coalition forces. And, you will learn throughout the time you work there. But some companies, their expectations were very high. They wanted somebody that speak very good English. And those people that they could speak very good English, they didn't want to work in war zones. They want to work in the cities close to their homes and families.
Funny how that works, right?
Yeah. And,
I forgot about that until you said it. But yeah, that was, as a matter of fact, I didn't even notice it until you've been in there for a while. But for sure, what unit, what was the first unit you strapped up with?
So back then, I didn't even know what, I mean, special operation is, what conventional units are. So I started working with the Canadians, and it helped me a lot, to be honest, with the Canadians, because Canadians have these three regiments, and they had like three deployments. One was the French regiment, and the one was, you know, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. But these were the regiments, and they had their recon and special operation units. So the team I started working with was Joint Task Force 2, like Canadian Special Forces. And my English, man, my English was so weak. I would, from a whole sentence, or like when you talk to me, I would understand like 30, 40% of it. And then I was just trying to play smart, be smart and not to give away that I don't understand much. And unless it's like a very important matter, which they weren't using as locals back then for that, then I would ask him like, hey, could you, you know, repeat what you said? I don't understand it. And then I started with the Canadian SF, and there was a French regiment. And the funny part was, so most of these French guys, they couldn't even speak English. So for me, it was a help, because I could just flex that few English I knew on these Canadian French guys. They were cool. They were, you know, SF guys. They're always, you know, my favorite band of the brothers. And they were pretty cool. They were always supportive. And, you know, they were always looking at me laughing at my English, because it was a pretty awkward way English I had back then. I mean, I don't speak great English now either, but it was pretty bad back then.
Yeah, you do. You speak it just fine. I don't speak good English. You speak good English. So don't worry about it. It's the difference between getting your point across right away as opposed to, you know, not.
Yeah. And so I was, then, you know, I started working for them. And my success with that letter at the beginning was I always tried to understand and not translate word by word. So I would explain to them, because of the culture difference, and there are a lot of difference, and that what made my job easier for me. So I would explain to them in my own way, and they would understand it. And I'm sure, Marcus, you have this feeling, like, you know, when you Terp does a good translation, you have that feeling.
It was the best. And then when you're sitting there, a new guy comes in and starts going to the number, and you got this guy just talking for 15, 20 minutes. And then the terp turned around and said, he's fine. I'm like,
yeah,
what?
And
it took him that long to just tell me he was fine. There's got to be something more in there. And then it was developing a relationship with our terp, because once we buddied up with them, like, I'm still buddies with them. And you get that flow, because then it is. It's not just speaking the language, man. It's like, what's going on in that neighborhood? And in America, if you walk into any neighborhood, they're all different. And there, you can walk in, somebody could have been in an argument or something. There could have been a family argument going on. And the worst was what the neighbors would get pissed at the other neighbor and be like, hey, the bad guy's in that house right there. And he wasn't a bad guy. He was just pissed at his neighbor. So getting through all that stuff in the beginning was, sure, it was tough.
Oh, yeah. Local Terps were pretty good, because, you know, Afghans... it's pretty common in Afghanistan. We speak loud, and then back here in the U.S., especially nowadays, with some of these young generation, when you talk to them, they're like, "Why are you yelling at me?" Like, I'm not yelling.
It's a city thing. They do that.
Yeah.
It's like, man, I thought that dude was yelling at me the whole damn time.
You know, of course. Some of the troops, especially the conventional army, you know, we called it back then regular army, because, you know, most of them were first time deployment and they were young. They didn't know much about the country. And, you know, of course, they never seen people talk like that. And especially when they were talking on the phone, they're like, hey, what's going on? Where are you? They're like, is he fighting? I was like, nah, he's just talking.
I'm just talking to you, man.
Just regular talk.
It's like dealing with a New Yorker. I thought you were yelling at me the first 2 years of our relationship. Come to find out, you're just talking. Especially when you get the hands going. When they start getting the hands, they'll get up close to you and they're trying to extend. And Afghans are great. They're kind of like Texans. If they don't know the language, they just talk louder. Like, that helps. And you're like,
oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
That was the best. So yeah. You patched up with the Canadians. That was your, what was your first mission? What was that like?
First mission was, to be honest, was very scary for me because, you know, of course, when you go to a new place, especially in the military, it's an area called war zone, you know, of course, you ask around like, hey, what's going on? What's the ID situation here as suicide bombing, ambushes, where what areas are bad? So the area that I was assigned in Panjwayi, which was like one of the worst districts for the Kandahar province, you know, even till 2 years ago was like one of the worst places. And so I was assigned there. And then the first mission when we went out, and you know, I don't know if back then you guys had I'm sure you guys had the ICAM scanners that you listen to the Taliban chatter.
Yeah.
And so they gave me one of these ICAM scanners, and then. You know, of course, I didn't have because I was new, and the Canadians have a little different rules on for the Terps carrying guns and stuff compared to the U.S. Special Operation was very different back then. And then they didn't give us any guns and stuff. So yeah, I only had a body armor and a helmet, and I have this scanner that I'm listening to the Taliban conversation, and I took everything serious that they say. Yeah, and like, oh, they started talking about us. We were doing this little patrol in this village, like my first ever mission. And then I'm listening to them. They're like, oh, I see him. Oh, you prepare your guns. Oh, let's ambush him. Let's shoot him. And then, you know, of course you get scared. Like, oh, they're going to shoot at you. Especially a person like me, I don't have a gun to fight. So the best option for me would be just, you know, just drop on the ground, you know, lay there. Let these bullets fly over your head and, you know, let these guys fight it because you don't have anything to fight. You can't throw rocks at them. And then that was my first experience. So then we went to this village and I was just the captain, the team commander was in front of me. So I was just doing what he was doing. If he was going kneeling position, I was going kneeling. In that one case, he went prone position when I told them that, you know, they might ambush us. They're talking about shooting at us till we found out that they are just bluffing. Like sometimes, and sometimes it was real. Like they would say we are going to ambush and they would ambush. So we always took it serious because an intelligence, they say, no matter how weak the intel is, but you have to always take it serious. It might be, you know, pretty solid, accurate intel, but it might be just, you know, information from nowhere.
I remember that. I remember that. I remember going out the first time, too. I had my armor up, I had my rifle on, and then I look over, and then the Turk was standing there with a helmet and a radio. I was like, well, I really don't feel scared anymore. Actually, yeah. I feel like an asshole for feeling scared because you're standing over there with a damn radio. Well, that was it. I mean, man, it was pretty Western back in those days. We're still trying to figure everything out.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? I mean, that was crazy, bro. Especially now, the way it's over now, but the way it escalated in the beginning and then it kind of had a drawn-out pattern and it would get violent and it would slow down and then every town would change. Man, it was dynamic for sure. How long were you with the Canadians?
Yeah. So I did 1 year with the Canadians, and I just didn't like, I mean, me as an Afghan, generally Afghans are like this. If you're not really used to being listening to a lot of rules and regulation. And back then, this was one of the main problems of the coalition forces that I've noticed throughout all these years was lack of trust between some of the teams with their Terps, you know, till they get to know them. So because I don't blame the teams, I never blame the teams because when they are getting deployed pre-deployment, they tell them like, you know, mom, that's what I heard from one of the operators. He said like we were told like not to trust the locals, you know, because you know maybe something might go sideways. And so there was this trust issue all the time, and they were always like, our phone was always locked, so and we couldn't talk to we could only talk to our families like once a week. And the Canadian has like more restrictions and rules, and then so I didn't just really like it. And I ate MREs for 7 months straight.
That was good morning, for you.
Yeah.
That'll put some hair on your chest, bro. Eating freaking MREs for a year.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, as I told you, one of the reasons that I started working was to have at least some good food, right? You know, you're fighting. I just, at least when you die, you just don't die from like, okay, I was hungry when I died. I was always like, okay, when I die, I want to feel like, okay, you know, I was full. I didn't need more food. So I was, you know, happily died. That was my motto back then. And gym was, of course, part of it. And then, so the Canadians has a lot of rules, restrictions, no good food, no good shower, and the pay was pretty low. And for me, I, because of the, not gangster, but that Wild West mindset I had, I was like, you know, it's time to start working with the Americans.
I was about to say, you got that Wild West mentality, you got to come work with us. We're the ones that embody that. Everybody knows it.
And then, you know, I said, you know, man, it's hard with these Canadians, bro. They got too many rules. Canadians have warrant officers in the teams, you know.
Yeah.
But in the army, I don't know. I never worked with the conventional army. But the Canadians have these warrants. So one of the things probably wasn't good. I was saying it, because I was young, I never thought about it. I was always flexing Americans on the Canadians, and they never liked it.
I'm sure they love that.
Yeah,
because we do that to them as well. I mean, we come at them even harder. Love you, Canadians. I really do. But I mean, that's a thing, though. We mess with each other hardcore.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, back then, Canadians were mainly running just southern Afghanistan, like, you know, Kandahar and the area. And I know Americans were like all over the country, and you know, bigger bases, massive bases were with the Americans, and smaller portion of it was with the Canadian. Because you know, we had, I don't know, 70 countries that was in the country. Romanians, you have you know, Lithuanians, you have everybody.
You'd see them. Yeah, I remember that. Be like, hey man, there's a bunch of different countries here. I'm like, where they at? And then out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, out in the middle of nowhere. And you run across them. The Polish guys, we worked with them sometimes, man. The Canadians, the French. Yeah, man, they were all out there.
French, the Dutch, you know, he had Dutches. Romanian was one of the, you know, of course, I felt bad for him. They didn't even have anything. I looked at them as like, man, they are in a situation. They need help themselves. But, you know, they're out here helping us. But, you know, God bless them. So,
right. Whoever threw them out there like that. I mean, that's what I'm saying. That was funny. I'm like, who are you guys?
So where do they stay? Who
the hell are y'all? How'd you even get here? Nobody even recognized their flag, which I'm not trying to throw a shot at them. I'm just like, man, some of them countries, you got to hand it to them, man. He's like, hey, we got four dudes. Here you go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Remember that Yusuf? They'd just be like, and there'd only be a handful of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very small number of them. And then you're like, man. So they would get feed in the American DFAC because they didn't have their own DFAC. And, you know, one of the biggest flicks that I wanted to have, because of the restrictions back with the Canadians and, you know, a lot of rules, and because we were in a regular army base and our team was very small and we were just, you know, embedded with the, you know, regular Canadian forces. We just had one tent and, you know, in that big base. And so there was not much of, like, I was like, you know, you're in a war zone. You don't know. You might die any second you step out of the wire. Maybe you get IDF, the rocket attacks on the base. You know, maybe you die. Just, you know, why not have that, like, little freedom? This was, like, one of the things I always told the team commanders and the warrants, the people I work with, especially back then with the Canadians. I said, hey, man, let me tell you this. If I want to kind of snitch on you guys, you know, sell you guys out, I don't even need to. I mean, I'm smart not to use my, phone that I have. You know, I can easily buy a phone for $20 from outside with a SIM card in it and sell you guys out. But have you guys ever thought about it? Like, why would I sell you guys out? I'm walking on the same walking patrol that you guys are walking. And it's like I'm selling myself out. And I'm from northern Afghanistan and I'm working in the southern Afghanistan. I don't even know. Like any of these people in this village, they look at me more in a bad way.
Oh yeah,
they look at me.
There you go, I got the worst. Yeah, sure.
You remember, you know, they looked at the Terps worse than they were looking at the, you know, coalition forces. They were like, you know, these were the infidel, if you kill a Turk, they were, you know, they made up so many stuff that for their Taliban fighters, you know, if you kill a Turk, their first target was always the Turk, because, you know, if you kill the Turk, there's no communication between the coalition and the village, people in the village. So it might cancel their operation. So we were the biggest target. And then, of course, you don't have a gun. And you from the 200 yards, say, or I don't know, 2,000 meters, everybody can see you're an Afghan or you're local among these, you know, coalition troops. So I left the Canadian, and then I, you know, when I told the warrant a lot of stuff, I was like, man, you guys don't have shit. We are fucking starving. I'm sorry for swearing, but, you know. So, and then the warrant got pissed. He said, when you go back to your American friends, then you can do whatever you want, not here with us. And I said, okay, sure, you know, I'm just going to, you know, give you my resignation. That doesn't mean that I'm resigning from being this, doing this job, just resigning from your team and try to go back to the Kandahar airfield, CAF, and get to start working with the American SF unit. And then, so he told me, like, okay, he told me F off at the end. He was so pissed because of, you know, me always flexing the American on them. There was only one team sergeant. His name was McDougall. I don't really exactly remember his name, but it was like 13 years ago. He told me, man, go back with the Americans, bro. We don't have shit. Just go back with the Americans. You know, you can go out there, kick some doors, you know, do what you want to do. And also, not, of course, I don't want people listening to this podcast take this idea of that, you know, Americans were like, you know, doing this Wild West, going, you know, killing everybody. It was just, you know, you had more support when you were working with them. And then, so resigned, and then came back to Kandahar, the base. They said, we don't have any team, nowadays we don't have any spot with the special forces. And I said, they told me, if you want to work with the conventional, the regular army, I said, no, man, I'm not really into rules and restriction. So I went to Kabul. I was going on my leave, and during this leave, I had 1 month leave because I was in on base like for 4 or 5 months back then. And then I said, I'm going to find, I went to Camp Phoenix back again to the Camp Phoenix. And I, you know, I passed pretty quick. And I told them at the beginning, at the, when I entered and when I passed, I said, hey, I don't care where you're going to send me, what part of the country you're going to send me. If you're going to assign me with a, you know, ODA or a SEAL team, you know, any special operation unit, I'm going to work with you guys. If not, you know, I don't want to work with you guys. And then, you know, 25 Turks were selected from like 50, 60 people. And none of them had the experience. None of them were being out, you know, in the combat or in the war zone. They were all new. And my emphasis was always like, you know, assign me with a special operation team. Assign me with a special operation team. And most of these new guys were scared to go to Kandahar, Helmand. And back then, I think Marja, the operation, the big operation that started the clearing operation in Helmand, it was called the Marja operation.
Yeah.
That was happening. And they were hiring a lot of Terps because it was a like massive, big clearing operation trying to clear all these Taliban off the Helmand province. And so we all get assigned these 25 Terps. We were assigned to go to Kandahar, and they will give us an assignment back there. So it's last day of this. We had 2 weeks of English training for the new guys. You know, I had to be part of it because I was new with the company. And at the end of this 2 week training, the head of the company came and told me, he said, you speak better English than these new guys. Could you talk about a topic? Because we have, you know, a colonel coming. You know, colonel was a big deal back in these bases because a general was like, a general was running like half of the country. So colonel was a big deal. And so the colonel is coming and some, you know, reporters are coming, you know, American reporters to see what this training does to these new Terps. And then, so I said, okay, sure. What do you want me to talk about? They said leadership. And but till back then, I didn't know that leadership is an acronym. It's like, you know, abbreviation. Every letter stands for something. I thought leadership is, you know, just a word. And so I put the leadership. I spelled the leadership in my hand with a marker so I don't forget the letters. And I started talking about it. I don't know, man. That was God's blessing. I started talking this so perfect English that it looked like my father was from downtown Texas and my mom was, I don't know, from Wyoming or somewhere. And,
Iowa.
You know, yeah, or Ohio. And so I did this beautiful briefing that everybody, this one guy, this one asshole, I'm sorry, he stand up, he asked me this question in the middle of this briefing, and I'm stressed out. It's my first time doing something like this in front of, you know, a lot of Terps, that the experienced Terps who were sitting on the other side watching this presentation. He asked me something. I forgot what the question was. He asked me something, and I was stressed out. And I swear, if he would have, you know, kind of emphasized on his question, I would have maybe lost it. And I did this trick. I asked him the question back again. I said, what do you think of this? So he asked me his question, whatever the question was. I asked him back. I was like, what do you think of this? And then, man, the guy was jammed. He couldn't say a word. He just sat down. And then I just cut that part of the question because I didn't know what to tell him. So I started this, given experience, examples from the, you know, my motto, my speech was always special operation, special operation. You know, of course, a special operation is special. And so but it was a big deal among the Terps too, you know. You know, I'm sure, Marcus, you remember in the bases, if you're an operator, everybody will respect you and everybody looks at you like, okay, man, he is not like a gang, but they look at you like as a role model, like, okay, these are tough guys, these are cool guys. And for me, it was like, I want to be part of that cool guy and tough guy thing. And so for the Terps was the same thing. So if you were working with the special operation, yeah, you could flex on the other Terps like, man, we're working with these, you know, badass mofos out here, you know, kicking doors, going out there, smoking this, you know, bad guys during these, you know, missions and stuff. And one of the biggest flex was like, you could carry a gun if you're working with the special operation. So anyway, story.
Shit, man, we armed ours up big time. I don't even have them in their room. Deployment, they were so good. Yeah, one of our guys, he had 2,000 combat operations. We actually had a ceremony and pinned him with a trident. We made him a SEAL.
That's something nobody can understand it, but as a guy who come in as a local and then you get to that point that, you know, this brotherhood applaud you and praise you like that. But something, that feeling is like, you know, it's like the greatest feeling. You can't really explain it to
man. They were
people.
Hardest dudes. Yeah. I mean, we would like stack them down with stuff. Never said one word. Never complained about anything. First one over the wall with us. Last one out. They were badasses, man. I mean, and it was we're talking about, this is in Ramadi. This is a hardest freaking deployment I ever had to go on, man. And every team guy in there showed up and we pinned that sucker. I never seen that happen before or since, man, but he deserved it for sure.
Yeah.
How long were you?
Yeah.
What was your total duration of time from the time you signed up at 16 till what?
So when I started with the US, the question was, you know, how long I did it, if I'm not what was the question? Yeah, so you know, back it was just 1 year, and you know, with that, with the Canadian SF, and now I started with the American SF. That story is, it's a long story, you know, how I end up getting I got lucky. I got assignment with the ODS-7 group in Kabul, which was pretty rare. Like, you wouldn't get assignments with the regular army in the Kabul, and man, you get so lucky that you get assigned to the special operation in Kabul City. It means you get to go home. I wasn't really a home type of guy because I wasn't married. I was single. And I was like, you know, this is my home. I love what I do. And then, you know, I would just visit home like every once in a month when I was in Kabul. And so my first assignment in the U.S. was with the ODS 7 group. And we were stationed in Camp Moorhead, which was in Kabul. I don't know, was it south side of north side of Kabul city? It was behind the Darlaman Palace, that, you know, the old palace where the former president was executed by the Russian Spetsnaz. And so there was this massive base called Camp Moorhead, like all special operation Afghan commandos. And then we were there for 3 months. And then from there, we moved to Bagram. We were in Camp Alpha for 4 months. And then, you know, Camp Alpha was like that top tier team. You know, you got DevGuru, you got CAG, you got, you know, so you got that top notch people there. And I did it 4 months there. And then the team went home and they didn't have any spot available. So I said, man, they asked me if I wanted to work with an army captain. And I said, man, no. I mean, I'm not, as I told you guys, not good with the rules, especially background was very, very restricted.
Yeah.
Because it was a massive base. It was like, you know, the central headquarter for the U.S. forces.
That's huge and now. Then, yeah, they built that thing up big time. And we're all flying there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The background was pretty, I mean, background was, if you would drive past Bagram, that city, which was called Charakar, which was like, you know, like 2 hours away from Bagram, in the Afghan roads, maybe in the U.S. roads, it would be a little closer. You could see Bagram from that city, and you could see that's not Afghanistan. People outside called it the small USA because of, you know, how things were built in Bagram, and you could see that these bright lights from like miles and miles away, and the rest of the areas all you know, like a, you know, that black hole, like dark, you can't see anything, but you could see that shine coming out of that place. And of course there were a lot of assumptions, like, you know, they do this in Bagram, they do that in Bagram. And like what I mean with this assumption is like they have nightclubs in Bagram. I'm not a nightclub or disco drinking type of guy, but they said they have these, they have that. So people from outside had a lot of these assumptions. And when Chinooks were background, you know, of course, had a lot of planes landing and taking off, especially CH-47, the Chinooks.
Yeah.
And they're like, man, they're bringing money, bags of money in these Chinooks, and they're dropping off this money here. And a lot of assumptions, the people who were outside were talking. They have these underground nuclear basement in background, near base, you know, that local stuff.
I can assure you that we didn't have a disco.
Yeah,
I looked for it. There's a couple of those sweet deals that they may be there now, but they damn sure weren't there. The coolest thing we had was that Burger King. But I mean, granted, now it's full, and I mean it's a. So there's a mall there and all kinds of stuff. It looks like Vegas. For anybody listening to this, if you kind of put it in your head, imagine flying into Vegas at night. It's kind of what it looks like.
So did you finally get the good food when you were with the Americans?
Oh, yeah. That's the food is the part I always love till today. Like, even nowadays, if I go somewhere and, you know, my friend, they don't want to eat, I'm like, man, I get pissed if you don't feed me. Either let's go to a restaurant, you know, but just my thing. Like,
that's,
you know,
the first thing that pisses me off is the food thing. If we don't have good food. I'm the same way, bro. I'm like, hey, man, as long as you feed me, I'll do whatever you want.
Exactly.
I'll fight as hard as you want. Just give me some good food. And not that damn Marmite tub freaking. I mean, we had that. Don't get me wrong. But, something decent. Well, your stomach's not like, what in the hell is that, boot leather?
So from there, you know, so contract was done, and then the supervisor was pretty, the site manager for the Terps, he was surprised when I declined the offer to work in Bagram close to home. And I was like, man, I'm going back to Kandahar. And he's like, are you crazy? I was like, no, I'm not crazy. I just, you know, so I you know, I forgot to tell you guys the part that I got blown up when I was working with the Canadians. We hit a roadside bomb with the IED, and it caused me this brain injury. I got this shock, and then till now I have this, I don't know if it's called PTSD or TBI, the exact the medical term for it. So my brain stops working, and like it blacks out, and it's brain seizure. And I took medication for it till today, and the doctor told me there's no cure for it. So as long as you're living, you have to take this medication, which I'm happy with it right now. That medication is controlling it. And so I got blown up back then when I was with the Canadian. Unfortunately, we lost two soldiers, a very, very young soldier, and it was pretty bad. There was a secondary device. So we drove over this IED. We were driving in this LAV, LAV, which was this Canadian armored vehicles. And then the IED hit, and it was my first experience, which is a very bad experience. And people who gone through that, like, nobody will understand it. That's like, you just go see Angel of Death for a second. He looks at you eye, and then you come back. You're that close to death. And death is something that I was never afraid of. It was more of like, you lose your hand, you lose your leg, especially in a country like Afghanistan. They won't give you a job. They won't let you work as a terp no more, of course. Then, man, the support was bad. We didn't have insurance, nothing at all that helps you cover you. So that was the main concern that I have. Like, I don't want to be the guy with no legs that won't be able to do anything. And this is my right. That was my dream job. And I didn't want anything to happen to it. So that brain injury, you know, happened to me, and from that explosion. So, and I told this guy, and I wanted to stay in the fight so I don't get that PTSD. Like, you know, when you go out of it, then you're like, man, this world doesn't seem like I'm not fitting in this society. Like, it's different. You can't tell these stories. You can't talk. Like, right now I'm talking to Marcus. It's like I have this feeling my soul is way back in one of these bases. And I'm thinking, like, I'm back in that one of these bases. We were sitting in front of the talk and in this next to the fire pit and talking. Because you can't talk to people. You can't tell these stories to people. They will have different assumptions, especially with the, as I said, some part of the society is getting very, very soft, which is unfortunate. And if you tell them, they will, you know, name you bad things. They think you're a baby killer or stuff like that, which they don't understand. I don't expect them to understand. Because that was something that they could never experience, and some might not even make it through that experience. So, but the best thing would be just, you know, to avoid it and not to talk to them. And so I wanted to stay in that fight so I can have that. I'm a guy, I love to talk because of, you know, share these stories, but you can't, of course, share with the civilians. They, as I said, they don't understand it. So I stayed in the fight, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to go back to Kandahar and stay in the fight so I can have that. I don't want to get that PTSD, like, man, I don't feel I'm in the society. So I went back to Kandahar, and then this was the funny part for me. I went back to that company. They didn't do the interview. They're like, are you good? You're a part of the company. And I said, man, I'm telling you, give me assign me with a special operation. If there is no special operation, you know, don't assign me with any other unit. And then, you know, these two bearded guy came in with the lowest civilian clothing in this room. And they're like, hey, man, these guys are hiring for a special operation. I was like, shit. Let's jump in. Let's get into that line that five, six people were standing in the line, because a lot of people are scared of working with special operation because of the risk that they were taking, the operations there, the raids or the operations they were doing. And but a lot of people didn't want to do it. And so I stood in that line, and, you know, I got to get in as the last guy. And so this was one of the things I told them during that whole interview. I told them, assign me wherever you want to assign me. Send me to whatever base you want to send me. Give me good food. Give me good gym. Man, don't matter where you want to send me. And they started laughing. They're like, you're the craziest person we ever seen. Like, you're just dying for food. I was like, we're fighting for food. Like, everybody's fighting to survive, right? So why not have a good meal before you die? And they just laughed. I laughed. And then they told me, okay, we know a good place for you. And so I was in my head when they said that we have a good place for you. I was thinking Kandahar Airfield had a base which was called Camp Simon, which was a base that the commando battalion, well, Afghan commando battalion was there. And then you had ODA, sometimes rotations were different. You had SEALs training and advising and doing operations with these guys. It was a good base, nice. You know, you're in Kandahar, you're in a cool base. You can flex on these army terps, you know, but hey, man, I'm working with the special operation here. You could go to CAF. So, you know, all that flex thing was in my head. So, you know, assignment day came in. They took me to Kandahar at the airfield itself, and we were waiting in this line for to go to the base. This is my first time ever I have seen a Navy SEAL. And because of the uniform pattern was different. And back then, not a lot of special operation had that, you know, cry precision, knee pad, you know, generation, whatever it called, like looking cool and badass uniforms. And you had these cut helmets, suppressed weapons. I was like, shit, man, that fucking looked badass. I mean,
it did, right? It does. We do. Yeah, we do, man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It was like you're staring at love of your life for a couple of minutes. That was the same thing for me. I'm like, man, yeah, that looks badass. And, you know, when you're in that environment, first thing for this is probably in a lot of special operation units, always look cool. That was one of the biggest things.
That's it. No, look, no matter what you do, make sure you look cool, man. Even when you're dying. Even if you're asleep, cool. You better look cool when you're asleep.
Exactly.
Right. There we go. Yeah, you're one of us.
And, you know, so I even I got into this Chinook or CH-47, and then we started flying. I was like, okay, look like I'm not assigned in this area. Let's see where we're going. So we had three stops on the way. And then I got to this HLZ that when we were landing, that dust came off. I still have the videos and everything. That dust came off, like that storm of dust, because of, you know, the CH-47 was blowing it off the ground. And I said, hopefully I'm not in this base, man. Look like it's in middle of nowhere. And they, the air crew look at me, is like, hey, this is where you're gonna get off. I'm like, fuck, shit. Look like we're going back to the bad place again. But, you know, let's see. Hopefully, my only concern was, like, I hope they have good food. That was the only concern I have.
Yeah, that was a deal breaker.
So I got off the Chinook. We were three people. It was me, Katu, a Terp that he came in from U.S. He was a U.S. citizen. And there's another Terp that he was, like, new. Like, he never done anything in combat or as a Terp. So we started walking, and then this bearded guy with all dust and everything on his face coming, and Tarjuman means a Terp in our language. And he looks at me and he looks at three of us and he's like, Tarjuman, Terp. I was like, yeah. He started screaming. He's like, oh shit, we got a Terp. And I said, shit, man, what kind of base is this? They're like, they look like nobody want to come and work here. So we started walking, and then, so this one guy, he mistook me. He thought I'm an American citizen, like Afghan American, and which were called catties. They had like clearance. And so he started showing me the talk. He started showing me the rooms and everything. And that catty Terp is right next to me. He's walking with us. And he's like, don't tell these Terps, you know, all these spots is just only for you. And so I understood at the time that, okay, shit. He's thinking that I'm a catty Terp. I came in from U.S., but he didn't know. I'm just, you know, a local Terp coming from one part of the country. And so he took me all these places. And then he's like, where you live back in the state? I was like, oh, I don't live back in the state. And my English was a little better back then, I think, you know. I was watching a lot of movies, learning from the movies. Then I was practicing it with the soldiers. that's why I talk a lot, because I learned English from talking a lot, and I got this habit of talking. And then he's like, "You speak good English. Are you not from US?" I was like, "Man, nah, I'm not. I'm just, you know, a local guy from one side of the country." He's like, "Who's the cat?" I was like, "Probably this guy behind me." And the cat guy was pissed because he felt like that, you know, he was feeling that, you know, they should have given him more credit because he's an American citizen. And he's those Turks were looking down on us, even though we were all Afghans. But there was this look that I never liked it, that they were looking down on us because we were local and they were from U.S. But on the other side, you had the special operation guys who were born in the U.S., their active duty, and they always look up on you. They're like, "Yeah, man, you guys are the best. You guys, you know," they always praise you for your work, and that gives you motivation. And so that character guy was like, "Oh shit," you know. So he wasn't happy anyway about that whole thing. So I went into the room, and then, you know, whole journey with the SEALs started. It was SEAL Team 4, which I still am in contact with some of the guys. I don't know, you might know, Marcus might know him, Jeff. He's in Alaska. He's got Jeff Frozen Trident.
Oh, yeah.
Jeff Reed.
Yeah.
So he's my like old buddy, like from back then. And he helped me a lot, you know. If he's hearing this podcast, he helped me a lot. Even when I came to US, he helped me a lot. And I always appreciate it. And he was one of the guys we always shared a lot of stories when we were doing missions on top of these mountains. We were almost at times together. And so it was my first experience with the SEALs. It was a good experience. And then, you know, it went on and went on.
You got a book coming out.
Yeah. It's called 5,000 Days of War, which is my 14 years in the combat. And that equals like to 5,000. And I mean, that, like, there are more details in that book, of course.
Oh yeah,
you can't.
Well, man, you've had an incredible story. Mm-hmm. You've had a great run on it, and thank. I mean, we won't be able to thank you enough. This country owes you a great debt, man, for stepping up and doing that. Not only that, going back in and then volunteering to work with our soft units. I mean, I want nothing but the best for you, man. I hope this book takes off. How do people find you? How do we follow you? I mean, how do I put this out to where people can get a chance to get a hold of your book?
So the book is the website that we have is Ballast Books. I'm sorry if I'm mistaken. It's like, so the easy way to get to that book is I do have an Instagram account, which a lot of people don't personally know me. It's the Instagram account. It's called Task Force Black or TF Black. And the book's also linked in that account, and it's also in the they can also go to this website, which is for ballastbooks.com, and they can get if they pre-order, they get a signed copy. We try to do it through our website so we can deal with the stuff ourselves, and instead of using Amazon or the other, you know, retail sites, because it gets a little complicated with them. And for us, you know, it's easier to use this, you know, the website that's for the book. And they can use, they I'm sure a lot of people, like almost everybody has this Instagram. They can go to TF Black or they can go to Ballast Books on Instagram. They can get the link and they can pre-order if they want a signed copy of the book. They can pre-order it. And so my, you know, thank you so much for giving me this chance to talk, because to, you know, spread this message. For me, the book is, why is it important? It's for people to know what really happened back in Afghanistan from, like, you know, the beginning, so that they can have a better knowledge of, you know, what really was going on in that war in the country, what could have been done that could have been better, especially that pullout, that mess that happened at the end. I mean, there's much details on it because we were there when the fall happened. I was there during the, you know, before the evacuation, during the evacuation, tell, you know, that the moment we lost those 13 U.S. service members,
yeah, at the end there.
May their, you know, souls rest in peace. I mean, there are like much more details and information why the fall happened. What was the one of the main reasons? Because you have the, unfortunately, you have the media in the U.S. Or in the West that doesn't cover details, and it's more of, I call them the snowflake media, as you know, Trump always says, fake news. I mean, I like him for that word, fake news, because they don't want you to hear what you want to hear. They give you what they want, what they want you to hear. So they always give you the information that you don't need it, but they sell you this wrong information. And so it's important that this book gets out and people understand the sacrifice that all these soldiers, not the Afghans, these coalition forces, the soldiers, a lot of soldiers, I've seen a lot of soldiers in front of my eyes. Unfortunately, they lost their lives. And man, that 20 years of fight, I mean, those lives didn't come easy. So let's not forget them. Their sacrifice. They weren't there for political reasons. Those soldiers were out there to help bring freedom. On the top, whatever politician was going on, it's something on the politics, but let's praise those soldiers that they were fighting to bring peace and stability to the country, which was very good. I mean, I saw a lot of changes in the country when the U.S. Was in the country. And I mean, I hope people, especially people in the West, don't forget the sacrifice that the U.S. and other countries made. But then, unfortunately, it went down the drain at the end because of the mess that happened. But, I hope people not forget that.
Thank you for sharing your story. We could listen to you all day. Unfortunately, we're on a time constraint. But
yeah, brother,
this
we're forever
amazing.
In your debt, man. I can't thank you enough. I look forward to meeting you face to face. We're going to do everything we can to push the book for you. God bless you, man, and continue in your success. Keep going forward, man. Keep pushing. Everything, the sky's the limit, man.
Thank you so much, Marcus. I don't want to forget this. I want to tell you this. The task force I was working at the end, they were guys in that task force, Afghans, that they were in that search and rescue operation after the Operation Red Wings.
Yes, sir.
But I still am in contact with those guys. They live here in U.S. They are safe. And that was a task force. And I always wanted to, you know, tell you this. But, you know, of course, we had never got the chance. But just wanted to share this information. Or that, you know, there were people always cared about you. And I mean, I'm very proud. I'm very proud that, you know, I'm talking to you. And I love, you know, your story and everything. Man, you guys are a hero, no matter what.
Oh, hell, man, y'all the ones that brought me back. I'll never forget that either. It's a mutually exclusive family now.
It is, brother. It is. Long live the brotherhood. And thanks so much for your time. And,
you bet, bro. You need anything, man. We're here for you. You understand?
Thanks so much.
All right, Yusuf. God bless you, man.
Bye. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.